what I learned from discussions we had during the coffee break there was that there's still a great passion for questions to do with Einstein and relativity, and I was sort of commenting to a few people in the class that maybe it's just a shame that the class I ran last year, that they hadn't been aware of that. What I would hope to do, just because of the constraints of time, is to do my best where appropriate to answer any such questions, but occasionally I kind of reserve the right to hold up my kind of red card and say, sorry folks, that's too far removed from the topic of this course. On the upside, however, a lot of the resources from previous days classes I've done are all still on the web. So if we just go back briefly and have a look at the link there, if you take the Hubble off the end here and replace that with Einstein slash, then you'll find all the resources from last year's course on Einstein's universe. The username and password is different. The username and password are both Einstein. So if anybody wants to have a look at those, you're most welcome. And, you know, within reason, I'll do my best to talk about those kind of questions as well. But there's so much interesting stuff to cover in this topic that I'm going to say, forgive me if I bring out the red card from time to time. See, our main focus in this course is telescopes. And I don't know whether Einstein ever looked through a telescope, but if he did, it would be for rather different reasons, just like myself, using them mainly for sort of recreational purposes. And indeed, a lot of the focus in IYE 2009 is to get more people doing just that. The Hubble telescope is fundamentally different as an experience, even for a professional astronomer, than using a small amateur telescope would be. I still get a great thrill going out in a dark night, looking through a telescope and seeing something like the rings of Saturn. There are beautiful images that Hubble has taken of the rings of Saturn and the planet as a whole, but even for those scientists working on those aspects of Hubble's mission, well, they would just be emailed the data. It's not quite the same. So I guess for me, one of the reasons why Hubble has been such a great success is its scientific contribution and the chance that it can let people become, if you like, armchair astronomers. But I think there's still nothing to beat, you know, every now and again going out there and having a look for yourself. And that was very much what Galileo did. And indeed, the primary function of IYE 2009 is to celebrate the contributions of Galileo to the birth of observational astronomy, looking up at the sky and seeing with a telescope things that you can't see with the naked eye. So in the autumn of 1609, he turned his telescope on the skies and saw some amazing things. Things which more or less overturned our view of the world and the place of the Earth in the universe. He published all of this in a book, which he called The Starry Messenger, a nice sort of poetic title. And what you see listed in the front cover here is some of the big highlights. If your Latin's up to scratch, you might see that this says four planets. He also refers to them as the Medicean stars, so even Galileo was a bit hazy on what was a star and what was a planet, because ironically enough, they were neither. They were actually moons. These were the moons of Jupiter, which he saw through his telescope. He was quite smart in one respect, because he named them after the Medici family, who were his sponsors, so it's always a good idea to do that. And you might have noticed a bunch of little sponsors logos down the bottom of my slides, you know, sponsors in the sense that they're the organisations that keep me in a job. There's Glasgow University. We're also part of what's called the Scottish University Physics Alliance, or SUPA, so you'll see that logo there as well. Now, Galileo's telescope was only a couple of inches across. That means the size of the lens at the top was just a few inches across. And what I want to begin with is just some thoughts and descriptions of what we really mean by a telescope, what the design consists of, things like that. So here's the dictionary definition of a telescope. It's an optical device for collecting light so as to form an image of a distant object. Now in that sense, our eyes are telescopes as well, because our eye collects light. The lens, which sits behind our pupil, the aperture through which the light passes, will then focus that light on the little cells in the back of our eyeball, which we detect and then magically, what seems rather magical to me, transform into an image of what it is we're looking at. Now, how does a telescope differ from that? Well, fundamentally, not very much, because the process is very much the same. The light is focused by a piece of glass, a lens. If it's a refracting telescope, although we'll see very shortly that hardly any telescopes are refractors these days, and then the focus light can be studied. The technology for building telescopes was around long before Galileo did his stuff, and indeed it's fair to say that Galileo deserves the credit for first using the telescope, or at least the widely reported usage of the telescope to do astronomy. But there certainly were telescopes around before, and there was a Dutch spectacle maker called Hans Lippershey, who the previous year, 1608, developed a design for a telescope. But as far as we're aware, he didn't use it for the kind of astronomical purposes that Galileo used it for. This is an even older painting from the late 16th century that shows, I think it's this woman here who's supposed to be the spectacle vendor. She's holding them up. Presumably this chap here is about to buy them. This is a market in Amsterdam. And if you go back much longer ago than that, well, here's Hans Lippershey's patent first for a device for seeing faraway things as though nearby. The Italian scientist Porta, he did a sketch in August 1609, which is essentially a sketch of the different parts of a telescope. There's the lens at the front and so on. If you go much further back than that, there's suggestions that the basic idea of using a lens to magnify what you see was well known for hundreds of years before Galileo. People would refer to what were called as reading stones, and here's an example of a glass lens on top of, a sort of medieval document, and with all those exotic Gothic letters. And indeed, the idea of using water to bend light, which we're familiar with, you know, the sort of optical illusion we get when you put a straw in a glass of water, there's a report from Roger Bacon, I think this is the 12th century, and I see my Latin's not up to it, but as I understand from what I've read, that this is a diagram suggesting how you could use a sphere of water to bend light from a distant object and then to focus that light. So the ideas had been around for a while, but Galileo was the one that first really put them into practice. And the basic design of the telescope that Galileo built is described in this little diagram here. So what you've got is a lens that takes the light from a distant object like this tower and bends that light. So as the light passes through the glass of the lens, it gets bent or refracted, and then the two light rays that we see, which are coming from different parts of the image, different parts of the object, pass through a focal point here, and then what happens is they pass through another lens. And what that lens does is, if you like, unbend the light. Because what's going on here is that you've got a very distant object, that's what's supposed to be represented in the diagram, so the light rays as they approach the first lens are essentially parallel, because, okay, they're not exactly parallel, but the object's thought to be so far away that the light rays, when they arrive at the first lens, are just parallel to each other. So what the eye of the observer sees after the light has passed through the focus and then gone through the second eyepiece lens is two parallel light rays again. But if you trace those rays back with the dotted lines, which is effectively where they appear to be coming from, then it appears as if they're coming from this dotted image, which, notice, is upside down, because telescopes will do that, but it's also much bigger. So the magnification that the telescope provides is determined basically by the focal length of the two lenses. The focal length is the distance required for a light ray hitting the lens to reach a focal point, in other words, where all the light rays will converge on each other. So, there's a few symbols here, so don't worry, we're not going to start rendering all of this in equation form, but the essence of it is that the more powerful the lens, the more it bends the light rays, then the more magnification you can get. And, you know, there's various formulae and equations that you can play around with to determine how much magnification you get. Now, that's very important if you want to look at terrestrial objects. If you want to look at something like a ship or a tower, and you want to know how much bigger that tower is. But magnification of an astronomical telescope in a way isn't that important, because you know the objects you're looking at are so far away anyway that if you make them a few hundred times closer, apparently, they're still very far away. But what crucially you can do is you can make the image bigger. So if you're looking at something like a planet, then you can see features on the planet that would have been too small to see before. That's how Galileo, okay, it wasn't a planet, he was looking at our moon, but you could see craters on the moon, which you can't see with the naked eye. And if you consider how telescopes have evolved in the 400 years since, it's really just been a constant quest to see smaller and smaller features on the objects you're looking at, that's smaller angles in the sky. And also, to collect more light, because the more light you can collect, the more detail you'll be able to see with a short exposure. Think of it like a camera. If a camera only has a very short exposure, then you won't see detail in a poorly lit room. If you increase the exposure time, then you'll see more detail. But the other way you can achieve that is by increasing the aperture of the shutter. So telescopes obey the same principles. But Galileo's telescope was far from perfect. Even the cheapest one that you might be able to pick up from, you know, a shop in the high street, the chances are it will be better than Galileo's was. Among the defects that Galileo suffered from is something called chromatic aberration. And this is because light gets bent by glass, but different colours of light get bent by different amounts. So the blue light gets focused here in my little diagram. The red light gets focused here. It's usually exaggerated in this picture, of course. So that means when you're looking at an object that's giving off light of all colours, the light gets smeared out. It doesn't all get focused together. And another type of effect that light suffers from when it passes through Galileo's type of telescope is what's called spherical aberration. Now, in terms of how Galileo ground the lens to make it as smooth a shape as he could make the lens spherical in shape. That means that what you're looking at is a little section cut through a sphere. Now, we define a sphere mathematically as a set of points that are all equidistant from one point, which is the centre of the sphere. So it's got a very special mathematical property, but unfortunately in terms of focusing the light, it's not that great. And what you see here is light rays that are passing through different parts of a lens which is spherical in shape, or part of a sphere. And again, you can just see perhaps in this cartoon illustration that they're not all being focused at the same point. Again, it's hugely exaggerated. The effect isn't that bad. Galileo was still able to see many things that the human eye couldn't see, and you know that's why his contribution is recognised as so important. But we'll see later in this introductory section that spherical aberration was to be a big problem initially for the Hubble telescope as well. And because it was such an impressive telescope in terms of its design, then even a tiny defect was enough to spoil that to a very great extent. Now, getting around the chromatic aberration, the colour aberration, is not too difficult. What you do is you construct the refractor lens out of two different types of glass, usually crown and flint glass. Those have got different, what we call refractive indices, the number that specifies how much colour of different wavelengths gets bent by the glass. And of course, it's not a totally perfect process, but what happens is the crown glass will bend certain colours of light more than others, but so too will the flint. And if you can attune the compound lens to be just right, then you can make all of the colours focus at more or less the same point in your telescope's design. So the fancy name for this is an achromatic doublet. It's, you know, two lenses. That's where the doublet bit comes in. And it's designed so that the amount of focusing doesn't depend anymore on what the colour of the light is, or at least not very much. So that's why it's called achromatic. Now, all sorts of telescope refractors were built through the the period, you know, 100 or so, few hundred years in fact, after Galileo. The other thing that can improve the performance of the telescope, as well as making the aperture bigger, is you can make the focal length longer of the telescope. So some refractors had these really elaborate long tubes. I forget where this one was from. I think this is a painting from an observatory in Germany in the 17th century, the latter half of the 17th century. As you can see, the astronomer stuck at this end. It's got a very, very long tube to manoeuvre. Here's a more recent example, you know, maybe recognisable to those of you who've got your own telescope. If it's a refractor, it won't be so different from this. And this is from the 19th century, and this would have been used in the field, so to speak, you know, one that's sort of transportable. You can fold up the tripod and take it to go observing with. I believe this one, this is a photo I took when I visited the Sydney Observatory a few years ago, and I believe this one was used to observe one of those transits of Venus that I mentioned before. So telescopes, very much like Galileo's, this basic refractor design, were still in widespread use, and you can buy one from the high street for, you know, if not a few tens of pounds, at least a few hundred pounds, you can get a very good one. And indeed, refractors, even well into the 20th century, were still being used for some very high-profile astronomical observations. There's a 24-inch, the 24 inches refers to the size of the aperture, that's, you know, across the diameter of the telescope. That was being used by Percival Lowell to look at Mars from the Flagstaff Observatory in Arizona in the early years of the 20th century. And, well, we probably all know the story, that he got a wee bit carried away by what he saw and managed to convince himself, at least, if not others, that there were man or Martian-made canal features on the surface of Mars. The world's largest refractor was built around then. It's 40 inches in aperture size, and it's operated by the University of Chicago. It's close to Lake Geneva, I think it's called, but not the Swiss Lake Geneva, in the state of Wisconsin. And it's still operational today, so that's quite an old photograph of it there, but here's a modern day one. And it's an impressive beast, and of course it's got lots of fancy electronics on it now that wouldn't have been there before. More on that in a subsequent week. We'll talk about how detectors have advanced just as the telescopes themselves have advanced. But if we now backpedal a bit to the late years of the 17th century, that's when a different type of telescope design first came to prominence, and it's what we call a reflector. And almost all big telescopes from the early 1800s onwards were reflectors, with the notable exception of, like, say, the Yerkes one. Almost all were reflectors. And certainly nowadays, any big telescope that's designed by professional astronomers has just got to be a reflector. Among the reasons are a less sensitivity to this chromatic aberration effect, a more compact design, and also just more manageable engineering. We'll see exactly what I mean by that in a moment. So how does a reflector work? Well, this image is of a prism that shows the bending of light as it passes through the triangular shaped glass. We see the light being dispersed into its different colours. So just like we saw a few minutes ago, the chromatic aberration effect spreads the light out. Glass, when it refracts light, when it bends light, will generally do that. But if you reflect light off glass, then it doesn't spread the colours to anything like the same extent. So reflectors are based on mirrors rather than lenses. And the basic design of a reflector goes like this. The light comes in, it bounces off the primary mirror, and then gets focused, just as you see in the lower diagram, back to a secondary mirror, which in Newton's original design from 1672 was just a piece of reflecting glass 45 degrees inclined that then bounces that light back through an eyepiece. Now that eyepiece will contain lenses. That will just be like in Galileo's design. That's designed to make the light as if it was, you know, parallel beams again, just as it was when it initially came from a distant source. Now, of course, you've got this whopping big secondary mirror in the way, but that doesn't matter so much because as long as it's not too large, and as long as the struts supporting it aren't too large, then you'll still be collecting a lot of light. And therefore, the crucial feature that makes this a big success, just in engineering terms, is that whereas a refractor has got the lens at the front of the telescope, a reflector has got the mirror at the back end. Now, if you consider that most of the time you're looking up there, then that means that the heaviest part of the telescope is generally going to be low down. Whereas if you want to build a refractor a bit like the Yerkes one, you've got a big 40-inch diameter lens at the top. You're going to need a very large counterweight to balance that. That's much less of a problem with a reflector. Now, of course, Newton's original design was a very small reflector, so those engineering considerations weren't so important, but they became increasingly important as bigger and bigger reflectors were built. So this Newtonian design is very simple. You've got the mirror at the back, the secondary mirror there, and the eyepiece. And you can make the aperture, well, really as large as your ability to make a curved mirror with good optical properties. In Newton's case, it was just a few inches aperture, but over the course of the few hundred years after that, the mirrors got bigger, the apertures got bigger, the telescopes got more and more powerful. The other thing that Newton did was, just like Galileo, he made his mirror spherical in curvature. And this little diagram here, so don't worry about, you know, some of the scary looking numbers and radius and things, just look at the picture. Essentially what's happening here is that the lines are representing incoming light rays, and then we're looking at how those light rays get focused. And if this shape is spherical, then the light rays across the aperture get focused over quite an extended region. Again, it's exaggerated a wee bit for effect, but that's because the shape is spherical. It's just to do with the geometry of how light will reflect off a spherical surface. The shape that you really want is what's called a parabola. If that's a word you've never heard before, don't worry, we're not going to go into the details, but it might maybe just trigger a few memories from your high school maths or, you know, other subjects related to that, because a parabolic surface has got a very different property. It really does focus incoming parallel rays at a single point. So it, also in 1672, there was another reflector designed by a French scientist called Cassegrain, which used a convex secondary mirror. So instead of in Newton's idea, the light bouncing off a 45 degree angle mirror and then going off to the side of the telescope, what happened with a Cassegrain is that the light would bounce off the primary mirror, back up to the secondary, but then back down again, so that the person looking through the telescope, just like with a refractor, could be at the bottom end of the telescope. Now actually, both have their pros and cons. If you want to look at something directly overhead, then the Newtonian one is quite a good design, because you can stand beside the telescope tube and look in at right angles. If you want to look at something overhead with a Cassegrain, you've got to bend your head all the way down and get below the main body of the telescope. But if you're looking at something at a lower altitude, then the Cassegrain design can often be more convenient. And here, just to show you, is where all the light rays are being focused with a parabolic reflector. So look, there's a nice clean focus there, whereas it's a bit more smeared out with the spherical. Just a little graphical illustration of the kind of ideas which, of course, can be described in terms of equations and formulae, and you can work all this out. The design of a parabolic mirror is quite a challenge to, you know, make the shape just right. It's easier to make a spherical mirror. But the advantages of the parabolic mirror are considerable, and again, pretty much all modern mirrors are closer to the parabolic design. Here's a couple of examples of Cassegrain telescopes. The one on the left is at an observatory in Germany. The one on the right is, as I'm sure you can see, not an optical telescope at all. It's a radio telescope essentially just a big satellite dish. Because what that satellite dish is doing is focusing radio waves towards a central focal point, and it's parabolic in shape. And indeed, well, I couldn't swear to this, I've never tried to measure it, but I think just your kind of bog standard sky satellite dish is basically parabolic in shape as well. Now, more modern telescope designs have taken things to a kind of higher level again. Even the Cassegrain and Newtonian design involves quite a long telescope tube. And one that came along around about the middle of the 20th century is the Schmidt-Cassegrain design. And this, in fact, is the basic design of the Hubble Space Telescope. And here what you've got is essentially the Cassegrain idea. The light comes in, this time it's coming from right to left, bounces off the primary mirror, comes back up to the secondary, and then comes out to the focal plane at the back end of the telescope. But before it even gets to the primary mirror, it passes through what's called a correcting plate. And the correcting plate is really just to fool the primary mirror into thinking that the light was coming from a telescope that was much longer. And therefore, what you can do is design a telescope that's got an effective focal length, which is essentially the distance from the mirror to the top end of the telescope, or it's related to that. You can make the effective focal length much longer than the actual length of the telescope. Now, I've got one of these in my office, and it's a 10-inch Meade Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. Looks just like that. The thing on the left is a 10-inch sort of standard Cassegrain design. And you can see that this is much, much longer, and therefore, in a sense, a wee bit more awkward to use and more unwieldy. And if you're trying to fit a telescope inside the payload bay of the space shuttle, as we'll see in the next session, then it's very important that you squeeze it into as small a space as you can. So the Schmidt-Cassegrain design was very successful for that reason. Okay? Let me just highlight another few telescopes through the ages. Anyone know who this is? William Herschel, that's right. And this is Herschel's 40-foot telescope, which in fact refers to the length of the tube rather than the aperture. Almost always when we say, you know, I have a 10-inch telescope, I have a 24-inch telescope, you're referring to the aperture size. Maybe Herschel just wanted to sound that bit more impressive. Indeed, to be fair, I don't know whether it's a term that he would have used, but historically it's come to be referred to as Herschel's 40-foot telescope. And indeed, for a long time I thought this was the one that he'd discovered the planet Uranus with. But actually, he discovered the planet Uranus with a much smaller telescope in 1781. This one was built probably with the kind of, you know, the rewards that came from finding a new planet between 1786 and 1789. So in the reign of King George III, and if you like me, I've probably learned most about George III by watching Blackadder. Nonetheless, I do understand that George III was a huge enthusiast for astronomy, and therefore, Herschel was probably in a very fortunate position of being able to get funding for astronomy projects much more readily than many astronomers nowadays do. But this was, for a long time, the world's biggest telescope. Unfortunately, of course, it was sighted in Britain, which means it doesn't get very many clear skies. But then this one, which later became the world's biggest telescope when it was built in the mid-19th century, is sighted in Ireland, which gets probably even fewer clear skies than where the Herschel one was. This is known as the Leviathan, very grand sounding name. It was built by the 3rd Earl of Ross, who, unlike Herschel, who had to get his money from George III and other sources, well, the Earl of Ross had his own money, so he could build his own telescope. But he was a very keen amateur astronomer as well. And to his great credit, despite the adverse weather conditions operating this in the middle of Ireland, it's close to Parsonstown is the name of the little village. It's quite close to Limerick, just on the road between Dublin and Limerick. And I visited there a few years ago, and the telescope had fallen into disrepair in the 20th century, but it's quite recently been renovated. It's not used for much serious purpose anymore, but it's very interesting to go and visit it, look at, you know, how people would have done things in the past. Basically, unlike all the smaller telescopes that went before, this one was not really very manoeuvrable. You could lift it up and down, but you couldn't move it very easily from right to left. But that's not such a big deal, because as you look at the night sky, the stars appear to move because the Earth is turning. So every now and then, the object you're wanting to look at will pass through what we call our meridian, if you're looking due south. And therefore, over the course of a year, you can still expect to see a lot of things. That's clear skies permitting. The typical number of clear skies that you would get in the Burcastle Leviathan Telescope, Leviathan of Parsonstown, would be, I think, about 50 per year. I mean, I can think of some years in Glasgow where that would be a good year, but that's what the records say. Whereas some of the best sites in the world where the biggest telescopes are built nowadays, you're looking at 350 clear nights a year. So having the world's biggest telescope in Ireland maybe wasn't such a good idea, but it was big. The aperture was roughly about the same size as the Hubble telescope. Therefore, it did allow us to look at things much more clearly and sharply than we could with smaller telescopes before. So this is about 90 inches across, 2.5 metres. And here is a sketch that was drawn by the third Earl of Ross of a nebula. What we now know, in as much as we know anything in science, is in fact a separate galaxy. It's a whole other galaxy, a spiral galaxy like our own Milky Way. It's called M51, another one of those M numbers. And it's in the constellation, if I've remembered rightly, of Canis Venatici, the hunting dogs. And it's many tens of light years, of millions of light years away. I think about 50 million light years, if I've remembered rightly. And modern day images of this that we'll see later with Hubble and indeed other ground-based telescopes are, of course, you know, astounding quality. It's a humbling thought to remember that for a very long time through the history of astronomy, what people had to do was look through the eyepiece, kind of memorise what they saw, and then make a quick sketch, and then look back again. And there are stories I used to hear when I was an undergraduate of astronomers who would have been doing most of their work through the early decades of this century, who developed a kind of brown patch around their eye, and it's where their eye would freeze onto the eyepiece when you were observing on a cold winter's night, and then every time you took it away from the eyepiece, some of the skin would get left behind. All very gruesome stuff. So it's a good job that what, of course, rapidly took over through the late 19th and then through the 20th century was, first of all, photographic plates and film, and then more recently, digital technology. But for a long time, you had to be a good artist as well as a good scientist. Now, when the Leviathan of Parsonstown ceased to be the world's biggest telescope, then the prize passed to the US. And that was in the late years of the 19th century when the 100-inch Hooker reflector was built in Mount Wilson. Now this one is close to Pasadena, on the outskirts of metropolitan Los Angeles. A rubbish place to put a telescope these days, but back in the early 20th century it wasn't so bad. And it's got an aperture just slightly bigger than the one in Burcastle, but it was a much better sight. At high altitude as well, comparatively so, a few thousand feet I think. And consequently it was used to do some really amazing things. Used principally by Edwin Hubble through the early decades of this century. And it remained the world's biggest telescope until, I think, if I've remembered rightly, 1948, when the 200-inch telescope with an aperture twice as large was built in Mount Palomar, which is just a few hours west of the Mount Wilson Observatory, a wee bit more inaccessible from Los Angeles, further away from the smog and all the pollution problems that were becoming ever greater in the 20th century. And when I was a kid, this was the world's biggest telescope, at least until a Russian one came along, a Soviet one, which I think was in, I used to know the name of the town, it's a long name, in the Ukraine. It's a 6-metre telescope. This was basically a 5-metre telescope. The one in the Ukraine really was never any good, because it was built in a location where the temperature changed enormously from winter to summer. And that meant that the mirror would contract in winter and expand in summer. So crucial to a telescope working well is having a stable environment in terms of temperature and everything else. so that the optics, the mirror, the lenses and so on, don't get disturbed and changed too much. So although, technically, the USSR, did hold the prize for the world's biggest telescope for a few decades, really, I think it's fair to say that hardly any good science came out of that telescope. It's a great pity, because, you know, it was, I suppose, done as much for politics as anything else, but it was a great opportunity to build yet another large telescope. But that one was one of the last where the mirror was one single piece of glass, of reflecting glass. Many of the subsequent telescopes were designed fundamentally differently, both in terms of how they would move as they tracked objects in the sky, and also in terms of how their mirrors were put together. So let me just kind of end on a few remarks to do with that. Let me see how we're doing. Yep, still got a wee bit of time. Notice that the 200-inch and also the 100-inch before it have got these enormous engineering contraptions to help them manoeuvre their way as you move them around the sky. The dome would rotate, and then the telescope could move up and down, and also in what we call azimuth, meaning, you know, horizontally. But the reason why they have this elaborate mounting system is because as you look at the night sky, the stars appear to move due to the Earth's rotation, with the notable exception of one star that hardly moves at all, which is this little bright one here, which is the pole star, Polaris. So this is an image taken by Fred Espenac, who's a very famous astrophotographer from the US. This, I believe, if I've remembered rightly, is in Utah. So it's at a latitude considerably lower than Glasgow. I think Utah's about 35 degrees north or so. So the altitude of the pole star in Utah is much lower down in the sky than it is here in Glasgow. And the stars will appear to turn over the course of the night around the sky as the Earth rotates. So that means if you can position your telescope so that one of the axis points about which the telescope rotates is aligned with the pole star, then it's very easy to track stars across the sky. But the drawback is you've got to have this very elaborate engineering structure to keep it all nicely balanced. So the 200-inch was designed in that manner, so was the 100-inch before it. But the subsequent design of telescopes would abandon this approach. This is called an equatorial mount. This is the very earliest example of one, and it's from the 17th century. And subsequent telescope designs, well, it would all be done with computers. This is the William Herschel telescope. Britain had a large stake in this. It's in La Palma in the Canary Islands. It was first commissioned in the 1980s and saw first light in the late 1980s. And it's 4.3 metres, so not as big as the Palomar, although, you know, for its time, it was still one of the biggest in the world. But crucially, if you go inside, the telescope would rotate horizontally and pivot vertically. And that means if it was trying to track a single object across the sky, then as the telescope moves, it would have to be quite a complicated combination of horizontal motion and vertical motion to keep the star centred in the focal plane. But that's not really a problem for computers to control such a motion, and it made the engineering much, much easier to handle because you didn't have the telescope sort of sitting at such a, at least when it wasn't in use, it wasn't sitting at such a oblique angle. And the telescope design of essentially all of the other large telescopes that you see listed here, and we'll go into much more of this in a couple of weeks' time when I come back, follows this pattern that engineering considerations drive the telescope design. You want to make it as big as you can, but you also want to make it stable. You want to make it as cheap as possible, and we'll look at some ways in which that can be achieved and how they relate to the design of the Hubble telescope in the next session. Did anyone see the Sky at Night special on the history of telescopes last week? Well, I've got a few excerpts from that, so I figured Patrick Moore and his various guests were explaining some of these things very clearly, so I would make use of those. So we'll pick up that story next time, where we'll look at the Keck telescopes, which are basically, until very recently, the biggest in the world. They've just been overtaken by one in the Canaries, the Gran Telescopio de Canarias. And then we'll look at the beginning of the next session. I know I haven't said all that much about Hubble yet, but, you know, part of this is to let you see how Hubble fits into the context of the history of telescopes. So, with apologies again for it being a 1 week hiatus, because you've got Alec next week, but I'll see you again on the 26th, and we'll pick up the story of the telescope with the Keck in Hawaii. Thanks very much.